Rock Station. Get ready to rock.
Hello and welcome again to another concert programme. My name's Bob Harris, and tonight really does promise to be a special programme, I think. It's the time of the season for saying about various bands, well, this is going to be their year, and I think that statement really does apply to our guest band tonight. I've not been so much excited by a band, hearing them for the first time, as I was when I heard Moving Waves for a very, very long time, and it's going to be a special evening tonight, I think. Having said all that, please welcome Focus.
What I remember is that it was in the fifth or sixth year in a row playing the same material, looking each other strange in the face. I was not up to that. I said, come on, man, we better take a distance from this all, because I feel like working in a factory. It was like spirit killing, playing the same material all over, exactly the same way as the previous. Well, literally, it had physical effect on me, you know, like you couldn't breathe. I felt like in a straitjacket or something. Musically, there was a lot of improvisation, but the improvisation started already become so much planned. I was fed up with that too. Maybe I was fed up with myself, with the whole thing. Well, the success, I think, came too fast. Too fast, that's the only thing I know. And when the success came, the whole business started changing around that little band, which I thought was brilliant in the beginning. The first kind of fusion type of rock, jazz, classical. I mean, it was a kind of music to me that actually didn't exist, you know. In that time, you also had the nice British groups like the Submachine, Pink Floyd. But Focus was more pure. Focus was pure romantic, sing song. We played songs, but not from the perspective of a pop song. Instrumental music, which is rare. Lately, I just listened back to some old songs, and I thought, well, shit. Ain't so bad after all. The whole world is playing like that now.
Strange, because the press always described us as antipodes, as very much extremes in character. I wouldn't say that that's true, because otherwise we wouldn't have made that intense music of our own. There has to be an outspoken alliance, a relation between him and me. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made it so intense and so high. We were backing also, let's say, well-known singers and girl singers in Holland. I even wrote some hits for them, but we never recorded under the name Trio Tijsmanlia. Martin Dresden was the one that I met at the radio session for jazz and poetry in Hilversum. That's the place where all our radio station and television is. Martin Dresden was, apart from being very good on his bass guitar, also you could consider him as a concept musician. He didn't write too much music, but he had a concept idea of how a band should be. And then suddenly Hans Kleuber was there during the same radio program later in the year. And then we wanted to start a trio. And I bought a Hammond organ, L100, started to play some Traffic covers. I was very fond of the music of Traffic, the old Traffic with Dave Mason and Steve Winwood. And then we started to play more and more of my composition.
The only thing I did was accepting an invitation of Mr. Ramses Shafi, which was a cabaretier, which was Van Leer was playing with at that time. And Shafi said, well, you have to play together because this and that, and blah, blah. So I did that. I did a jam with him in Amsterdam in this building of the Communist Party or something, of course, which was turned into a theater, which I think is better anyway. But they found out I did this jam with Van Leer and with Martin Dresden and Hans Clover. Martin Dresden's father was the head of the Dutch Conservatoria, and he was fucked up because of that. He only wanted to play rock and roll and jazz just because of that, and he was heavy on drugs and constantly out to lunch. But anyway, he was a brilliant bass player, I think, still. As soon as you start shooting up with something, it's less brilliant, I think. Doesn't make him less in my ears. Clover was a student in philosophy in the Amsterdam University, where I met him, because I was studying mathematics, which is off the wall because I still don't understand the shit. But I had to do something in order to get a scholarship to go to the conservatory. That was the Hans and Martin. This is how I met them. And Van Leer, of course, was obvious. He was almost desperate to play with me, but I didn't like him in the beginning. Why, I don't know. It's a kind of natural aversion. I don't know why, but you can have that sometimes. I don't know why. But they found out I did this jam with them, and I got kicked out of Brainbox. Because it would damage the exclusivity of the band Brainbox. That was the actual philosophy behind it. I mean, they must have scratched behind their ears after that, but still.
December 69, around Christmas, we had the first gig with Jan Akkerman in a place called the Birds Club in Amsterdam, which doesn't exist. And it was again this same Martin Dresden, bass player, who said, if ever you want a guitarist in the group, because I think, he said, we need a guitarist, not knowing that Jan would become such so much of a lead guitar that he nearly played, like, let's say, songs on his guitar without being a song band. Instrumental song type of material. Then Martin Dresden said that there's only one guy I would think of in Holland, and that's Jan Akkerman. And I knew Jan only from Brainbox and his work with Brainbox. Not too much I knew from Johnny and the Cellar Rockers and the other bands he had. The confrontation was great and very wild also, because we were rehearsing in a beautiful room, and Jan came in and sat down, and we played and jammed a lot for hours, and really it was kicking ass. I think that same night his manager came looking around the door, on the door, let's say, and he just opened the door a bit and showed only his face, and he said, Jan, stay there, I don't want you anymore in Brainbox. It was kind of a very desperate, jealous act, it seemed.
So actually, out of pure poverty, let's put it that way, I started playing with them because I got kicked out of my own band, Brainbox, which I happened to love. But there was also a lot of envy within that group. The singer, Caspix, was a kind of leader type, and Pierre was jealous. I don't know why, but things like that, boys, things happen, I guess. There I was in focus without me even realizing what the hell I was doing, and because I wasn't too charmed of them in the beginning. Anyway, I always loved the classical, I always loved jazz, ethnical music. That was actually my background. Before this whole rock period, they used to play a lot of Latin music and Django Reinhardt type of music. Before anything happened in like 66, 65, when the Beatles came, I liked the Shadows a lot, Hank B. Marvin, great music. So it's easy to put a link then, to make the link to Focus, actually. And coming out of this little hard rock band, hippie band, whatever, was a challenge for me, you know, to make that band Focus work, because they were only into esoteric bullshit, as I called it. It was for me a kick to let them rock. We'll be right back. just needed work, and somebody came up with the idea of being the backing band of Hair.
We played evening after evening, and also it gave us the opportunity to rehearse our own material during the day and not having to pay a penny for rehearsal money. I think we did it about 6 months and then had a stand-in band because our gigs became more important, the gigs of our own.
And why not? For me, it was an opportunity just to survive. It was in a tent near the Olympic Stadium in Amsterdam. 69, good year. Between things, you know, like Hair, musical Hair, we went to England and recorded our first album in the Church Street, the side road of King's Road, with Jerry Boyce. He was running this little studio there. It was a 4-track or an 8-track album. And I still think that our best material is made there, like Moving Waves and that first album, In and Out of Focus. The first single is recorded in Holland, House of the King, which is incorporated later on the album. Because the night I got kicked out of Brainbox, I got so angry, I wrote this piece of music in Spain somewhere. We had to do a gig for, I forgot what it was. It was kind of a talent scout thing. We played with a Big Sleep, and this old English band, and the old Chicken Shack. And it was in some place in Mallorca, in some nightclub called Barbarella's. And after 10 minutes when we played there, they pulled the plug out. So I was so furious, I wrecked the whole dressing room. I don't know what the hell happened. But I found myself between two guardias de filo with guns. And some old stewardess, some Spanish stewardess got me off the hook. And out of my angriness, I wrote this tune, House of the King. And as soon as we get back to Holland.
I must say that we had a few gigs already then. The guy that was best arranging that was Hans, the drummer. He knew he had some contacts with the student world, you know, so he played at student places. Very nice. I mean, Amsterdam those days was cooking. It was a great atmosphere there. Martin Dresden had a feeling that we had to look for a international management rather than a Dutch one. And he had a contact with Radio Luxembourg, based in Brussels, managing director of 18 different publishing firms, was called Hubert Terhek. He was actually interested to do a record with us, with our own material, with the songs we made, in London, in the Old Church Road, first studio we ever went in Britain. And that was actually, for us, such a thrill, because we were the first, I think we were the very first continental European group to do so, to do a whole album in England, which was actually the mecca for us, for rock, for let's say white rock. Of course, the main interest of this publisher, Mr. Terhagen, was to be a publisher rather than a production firm, but yeah. He also afforded us to do this production, of course, and he gave the money for it, and also gave us enough material, backline material, to cope with other groups in Holland, to play on festivals, and to really be able to compete. So, as a beginning band, we had an extraordinarily well-equipped backline. The instruments, we had very good instruments, very good amplifiers, and a very good PA that we also carried.
Terhagen, well, he had a second hand there in this, which was Mr. Edith de Jong. And he was a beer-drinking, bawdy person. I was reluctant to that person because the only thing he could shout 5 minutes before a gig was, "Play!" And that was it. This is how I got my name, probably as being a difficult, untrustworthy person, because he was closer to the press than I was, and if I arrived somewhere 5 minutes late, you know, the first thing that got out was, "Oh yeah, Mr. Jan Ackerman again," or this or that. You know, this is how you can influence. I didn't have too much trouble with that, but the only thing I was interested in was guitar playing, not realizing that it could damage my image or something like that, which I never cared about. I was a musician. Who cares about an image?
Then came the new phase, new era, was actually when Jan Akkerman wanted to play again with Pierre Van Vleuten. He put to me the question, do you want to stay with your old trio or you want to join me for a new adventure? Very appealing to me. So finally I decided to go with Pierre and with a new bass player called Cyril Hoverman.
Moving Waves, I arranged the whole thing, glued all those pieces together. Well, I never got the credit for that. Played the bass on the whole album, except for one piece, it's Tommy, which is played by Cyril Hoverman. But I played the bass on Hocus Pocus and all the other pieces. And I arranged the whole thing, like, in a rock way, because ties came with all these classical things, isn't that? I felt that it needed a rock touch. Yes, you were shifting bass players between Martin and Cyril Hoverman. And Cyril was a good singer and a man with good ideas, but he wasn't such a good bass player. He did the live gigs though, but you wouldn't notice him so much because there was so much other stuff going on with the drummer, which was brilliant. I think Pierre is brilliant. One of the only drummers I know which is who invented it for me. He's the greatest rock drummer around.
We were rehearsing in a castle nearby here in the mid of Holland, and Jan was playing this first riff. And then he did this down, 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 pop. And he left a break for the drummer. And Pierre did this, how many bars? Two or four, I don't know. Four bars. And then I started to yodel, like it is recorded. Then we did that for half an hour and we had fun. And we said, why don't we record it? But we never actually composed for a single. Composed albums, and there was, by chance, a single or not, or two, you know. We never thought commercially in that way.
Kind of made it up during a bottle of something. Those things come about,
I guess.
It's actually the basis of the whole hard rock thing. It's a kind of thing you can't explain, it just comes about. And I don't want to explain it either. I was in that kind of mood. That kind of feel. That lick that is really important musically to me. I don't care so much about yodeling. He started yodeling. I said, yeah, we keep that. We keep that. We make it a send-up. In this case, I have no problems with that because it would actually fit into this whole instrumental type of thing we were doing with the moving waves. Like, it was a send-up of ourselves. All the serious Monteverdi cathedral blown up fantasies, which was okay. I thought it was a beauty, pure beauty. I wouldn't be satisfied with the whole album, like moving ways, if there wasn't a touch of humor. You can't take yourself too seriously.
We did an English tour, the very first English tour, we did actually during the power strike. Nearly no English band toured then because of this problem.
We went over to England for the first time, and there was a power strike, like the electricity people, like power plants were on strike because of someone thought two nickels would make them happy, something like that. But we brought our own generator by accident because we thought we had to play an open air festival. And in that time, we just had an album out called Moving Waves. And nobody was able to play in London or England at all because of the power strike. And who were there with a generator? I mean, it sounds like a Trojan horse.
And we were to actually take a second van. The first van was loaded with our gear, and the second van had an accumulator for electricity. So we played with our own accumulator.
We had this generator with us, and we played the universities in that memorable week all around London, and they were packed because it was probably the only thing that was going on. And at the same time, we got a lot of airplay because people must have phoned to the BBC, like, you got to see this band or hear this band. And this is how the whole ball came to roll. It also has to do with, we got involved with Radio Luxembourg, and the director of that, of the music publishing department, had his wings spread all over England, Europe, America. And he had his ties with England, I guess, and people there. I mean, it all actually came into focus in that particular week. It was just a lucky shot, I guess. Not the music so much, but the whole situation.
And that made a big impression on the
the English on the British public. That actually made the first gossip about the band. We became Brightest Hope, Melody Maker, and we all were voted very high, and Jan even got number one above Clapton, that had been number one for 6 years in a row.
Tommy Barla, he was a horn player. I knew him from the time from Rainbox and before that. He plays the flute on one of the Rainbox songs called Dark Roads and Scarborough Fair. So I called that tune Tommy. Well, he's probably not a better flute player than Van Leer, but he was more bluesy, and that appealed more to me. Well, which proved it later on with all this introspection stuff, which is not my ballgame. If it was really quite classical, I would have liked it. Well, I heard it from him, and from Tommy, and I thought, well, and I just saw this movie by The Who, and I thought, well, this is nice. That's a nice coincidence. It really was. So I decided to play that. I loved the composition because I liked also Cannonball Adderley a lot. I listened a lot to that music in those days. And it all actually came together. It has a kind of gospel feel. Country Preacher, that album of Cannonball Adderley, it's still a classic. And it has that same taste, like when Adderley played a ballad, it had that flavor, harmonically.
Focus 3 has his appeals very much to me still, knowing that we only did 4 days to do the whole album. Focus 3 was actually played live in the studio, Olympic Studio 2, while David Bowie was doing his material in Studio 1. I couldn't believe that rhythm section of David Bowie, I remember, with Visconti as a producer, because it didn't swing to me at all what they were doing. And then when you heard the result after months and months, it suddenly had all the balls in the world. I couldn't understand that those days. I didn't know also the importance of a producer that much. We've been producing ourselves a lot. Then later came Mike Vernon to help us out. He came to a gig and played in the south of Holland in Limburg, and he was brought along by Hubert Ter Heggen, and I think he had liaison with Blue Horizon, and so with Sire also. That's also how we met Seymour Stein, of Sire. And Seymour Stein was the first to pick us up in the States. We were actually the first continental group for Seymour Stein that had success in the States. So you could even say that the basis of Seymour's huge success is Focus.
And we recorded Focus 3 with a long bass solo, which is almost a sleep song, I think. Which is nice in a busy album like that with three egos together, you know, to have a kind of a station called Peace. I mean, I always like Bream and I like blues music, and I like any kind of music, like Arabian music or even from Kenya or wherever. But I went to a couple of places just by myself, like near Oxfordshire, and I went to the Rollright Stones and the Tunes, and I understood that music suddenly. It was beautiful. I said, hey, that makes sense. It really did. So I started to play Elspeth of Nottingham. I mean, it has to do with that atmosphere, which I grabbed from these beautiful valleys and whatever, lilies and flowers. And the title is Mike Vernon, Elspeth of Nottingham, which happened to be a witch, I think. Well, I was really inspired by that era anyway, spiritually. I mean, I think Renaissance, I believed then that, and still do, that this whole period, like from the 60s on, was a Renaissance in this time. New instruments, like electrical instruments, new thoughts, flippies and hippies, and dope and all that shit. But that was a kind of Renaissance too. We were sitting in planes going through the States, like planes and trains and cars and all that. So the only possibilities to do was get pissed or do something. You know, going back and forth to Australia, Japan and all that. So we made a stop in Hong Kong, and I found this little Sanyo radio thing with a headphone and some hearing aid thing, which you could glue literally to a belly of a guitar. Some glue, chewing gum. And I was sitting in the back of the plane and hired myself 4 seats and got a book from England. I think it was Shots in Great Marble Street one, the English book tablature, and I didn't understand a shit of it. Well, let's learn to read some old English, you know, or got involved in it through that, the whole idea, you know, being in England, going to places, and Oxford and Cambridge, and they got the whole picture of this. I was interested how that must have been.
Sylvia was one of the girls in this cabaret group of Ramsey Shaffy, Sylvia Albers. And it was a lyric written by Linda van Dijk, who is now a movie actress here. And she wrote this beautiful lyric. I thought I could do everything on my own. I was always stripping the town alone. So I wrote this music on this lyric. And I had the intention to ask Sylvia to sing it in the show. She was not that interested. And finally, she didn't sing it at all. So it was in the cupboard there on the shelf. And then, just in order to pester her a little bit, I called the song after her name. Not at all having to do with any love affair. Or, you know, just to show her, you see, you're stupid not having taken it, you know, something like that. But it came out much stronger than I ever had expected it to be, especially because of the interpretation of Jan. The way he plays it is let's call it genius.
We did wedding. What didn't we do? The only thing I can remember is getting out of London at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, taking you 2 hours to get on the A1, and the fantastic food along those roads. Glasgow was fantastic. Played a couple of times there, and Exeter, I remember, Bristol. Funny, most funny places, and I loved it, every bit of it.
Reading, we had to, we played just before Beach Boys, I remember. Raining. It was raining like crazy. There were some technicians that kept our volume a bit down because we were not the real main act. And then our engineer, he just gave some, he boxed his way through by fist fighting to be on the board himself alone. And then he gave us the full volume on festivals. Mean things happen now and then.
A certain time our contract was running on empty with Sire, and we had something like 4 albums on the shelf, and we had to deliver the albums to him. So the albums were released at once in 73, I guess, and there were all 4 of them in the top 100 in America album charge, and that's 2 amazing singles in the top 10. So I found myself suddenly in the States after touring England and 2 years Holland.
I remember it very well. The very first gig was in Miami, and in the open air at the university grounds, and it was nice, but we considered it more or less as a general rehearsal, because the very next day we were playing New York City in the Lincoln Center in the Philharmonic Hall with a sold out hall, and also connected to the whole East Coast FM progressive stations with the Night Owl as an announcer, which was an older lady, let's say 40 years old. That was the in voice, you know, the voice that everyone liked to listen late at night. She was the sophisticated one, you know, interviewing all the big shots, you know. And she was treating us as the special thing coming from continental Europe. And we were so afraid, I remember, so nervous, that we nearly didn't know how to start. And then you have those balconies there, maybe you know the hall, few of those balconies that really tend over the stage, like you know the Muppet Show, the old cat. People from our management, that was apart from Seymour Stein of Sire, it was Lieber and Krebs, and they were then sewing white confetti, but full bags of it over us, just before when we were tuning the guitars. And that eased us so much that we actually played a very good concert in the midst of this snow of confetti. And, you know, then we listened back in the radio car after that, and we were really pleased because it had except for the tension, it also had a release. Nice combination of tension and release, which I think music always has. Very important thing for us as a band to break New York. And then, of course, we toured and toured and toured. We did, I think, 5 tours altogether of 2.5 months each. In England, we did 5 tours. And then the continent of Europe, of course, Scandinavia, Spain, Germany, a few tours. Italy, we never played. I don't know why. Australia and Japan, we did twice. Very nice. I think 74 and 75.
Hamburg Concerto is conceived while I was eating a piece of cheesecake watching Laurel and Hardy in the New York Hilton, which is the worst hotel in the world then. I mean, the rats were literally running around in overalls. Cockroaches was amazing. Black and white television, grayish room. But maybe they found out it was a rock star or something, so they put me in the ugliest room they had. And it stank there. That's actually where I wrote this thing, Hamburger Concerto.
Hamburger Concerto itself is a bit of a clone, a bit of a duplicate of Eruption. I think it's okay, but it's not as good as Moving Waves. It's heavy licks, maybe also of an influence of Joe Walsh. Played 9 gigs with Joe Walsh and Barnstorm just before he joined Eagles. We were not kind of the, you know, composers that can unpack their guitar in a hotel room and write a few chords and then have a song together. We were not at all that type of composers. Actually, the amount of touring dates jeopardized the quality of our composing. But we didn't know. We now see that was actually happening. It was pleasing to actually discover a lot of the world that maybe otherwise we would never have been. That was a great chance to get in all corners of the world. But on the other hand, we gradually lost the feelings with our roots, which was continental European. That's also what you see in the progression of the music. We seem to lose control of this European, if you want, classical, quote-unquote, quality. I can say now, you know, we were influenced also by the MOR radios that we heard, nice stereo sounding in the limousines that were fetching us from the airports. And of course we heard then very well-sounding Carpenter songs, you know. That's called the MOR thing. And that we unfortunately have been trying to copy also too much. But that was an American idiom that we shouldn't have touched at all, I think. I mean, we had a kind of a deal with this production company to produce every year one album, which in a few cases is not much. But in other cases, it's too much, you know. Sometimes you think, I have too much material, what can we do with it? But then, you know, if you tour too much and you don't have your thing together, then you are forced to do an album, or you're feeling to be forced, and then it comes out lousy.
I mean, what do you expect, playing from 70 on till end of 73 without a break? They wanted to come up with new material and new this. And I just wanted to take distance from the whole ballgame because I was fed up with it. Just fed up. It was like a sponge, you know? I mean, the mediocrity always comes up as something acceptable, but I felt like a sponge who was totally pressed out, squashed out. Whatever you want to call it. I just wanted to play the guitar, but at that time I thought, well, Van Leer came out with this. We had all these albums in the charts in England, in Japan, everywhere in the world they were in the chart. And he came out with this classical solo stuff, which was I thought it was a sellout of the ideas, which were pure, and not only ideas, but it was all ideal. And I felt like, where the hell am I? Actually, why do I play myself every night to bits and pieces with that ideal in my head of making pure music. If somebody else within your own group sells it out to the general public.
Introspection sold officially more than a million albums in Holland alone. And I think unofficially it's more than 2.5. Till now, maybe it will change tomorrow, I am the best sold album artist. That happened. That suddenly, the sudden success of Introspection was also due to evening that I performed two pieces with orchestra and Roger van Otterlo conducting live on TV. And then suddenly I sold 100,000 the week after. And it stayed for 100 weeks in the top 20. I said, yeah, but what can I do? Because the focus is now so doing well, and I don't want to interfere. And then actually the members of Focus made an agreement amongst each other that we allowed each other to do records solo, but not too much performing with it. Then maybe here and there a TV, but not really touring with it, and keep the touring for the group on. That actually worked for quite some years. But of course, the huge success of Introspection had also a negative influence on the atmosphere in the band. Because of course, at that same time, Jan Akkerman made also records, and Cyril Havermans even did two solo records. But Introspection became suddenly a huge hit. That also made a different image for me, because people identified me as the flute player of the soft, friendly songs, rather than the rocker behind the Hammond organ. Already actually producing an ambivalence, which I produced myself, of course. A strange kind of schisma, which I didn't notice, of course, because I was I was enthusiastic for both, but I think that it didn't have a good influence on the spirit of the band.
Actually, in interviews since 73, he emphasized that I was a kind of musical laborer, and he was the genius. Yeah, sure, in newspapers. So I'm not talking out of nowhere. It has all a reason. All has a reason. Not that I can't forgive or anything like that. It's all forgiven, but not forgotten. I felt like being misused. I didn't realize that he already looked at the thing as being his hobby, this whole Focus thing, because he was making millions with his Introspection. So I didn't realize that. When Pierre left, which was already a kind of inner game, this power game within this band, it was Thijs van Leeren's ball game. He wanted Pierre to split, so he had a free hand more to do whatever he wanted to see. So he broke up the kind of tandem I had with Pierre rhythmically. He always was very jealous at that, because he didn't fit in there. So I actually don't care so much, because for me it was finito anyway, with Colin Allen. Not that Colin was not a good guy. Colin was a nice guy, and Colin liked to smoke dope and lay on his back in the studio and say, you're the composer. I mean, I never felt shit what I'm doing. What the hell am I doing here? God, get me out of here.
We were expected to do another English tour. Jan, I think he was right in saying that the material was, let's say, not strong enough, and I was also making more jazz rock kind of themes and not enough of that old feeling anymore. So he suggested that we would wait half a year, and our road manager, Ethan de Jong, who was actually the right hand of Mr. De Hagen, he spoke to the organizers in England, and they actually agreed in postponing the tour half a year later. And then came the moment that we had to go, because doing this promise, you cannot cancel it twice, you know. And there was a very strange thing happening, that Jan again said that he didn't like my material. Yeah. And I was actually then like always, I was writing the bulk of the material. And having Jan as a soloist saying that he didn't like the things I wrote was kind of a difficult thing for me to swallow. And then I still persisted in going on with the trio without him. I was a bit sick, I remember. And I just studied with the bass and the drums and the keyboards this material that I already knew that Jan was not too much a fan of. I studied it in without Jan in the rehearsal room. The few days before we had to go to England, and we actually had to because otherwise we would have been sued for the rest of our lives. I remember Jan came in and he disagreed with a bit of music. And then I said something terrible. I said, oh, please, Jan, then stay away out of the group because the group has to go on. So I took this terrible decision of asking him to not be present anymore in the group. And it was a lot of pain, but, you know, he didn't come up too much with an alternative composition-wise. I had that feeling, so I suddenly took the authority of putting my compositions as a nuclear thing more than ever before, also urged by the pressure of having to do this tour. That was really a terrible experience, and so we separated then. We rehearsed after this tour in England, we rehearsed for a few weeks in Holland, and we did our best, but I had all the time the feeling that without Jan, it could not be. I mean, it was a nice group, but it could not be called Focus anymore.
Focus and Sneezing Bull from the last of the 1970s albums, Focus Con Proby, with Philippe Catherine on guitar. And this was indeed the end of an era. Following Thijs van Leer's appearance on Jan Akkerman's 1984 album, From the Basement, the two reconvened in 1985 for a surprise album, which according to van Leer yielded about 30 songs. Perhaps ironically, this project had been suggested by the instigator of the introspection albums for van Leer, Rud Jacobs. 5 years later, the original classic band lineup returned for a televised concert in the Dutch Gold of Gold series. But after two decades, this was their last outing, and the two main protagonists have not worked together since an appearance at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1993. Van Leer has, of course, reconstituted the band Focus in the millennium, including drummer Pierre van der Linden, and with several albums and many tours, especially in the UK. Jan Akkerman continues to tour and record with his own band. Bert Reuter died in 2022. For the past hour, you've been listening to Focus on Focus, with tracks taken from the highly recommended multi-disc box set anthology released in 2020. The interviews were part of my research for the Record Collector feature published in May 1991 and took place in July and August 1990. You'll find additional features and reviews at getreadytorock.com, and there's more information in the unauthorised biography In and Out of Focus, The Music of Jan Akkerman and Focus, published in 2003. From me, David Randall, thank you for listening. We'll leave you with a track from that 1985 album, Focus, Ole Judy.